This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. And even though there have been many, many challenges that Hoosier communities have been facing in recent years, there is a new survey that has come out recently that says that 85% of local elected officials are very optimistic about the future of their communities. It's all from a survey that has been conducted by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute. And the chief researcher in the project is Jamie Palmer, and she's joining us from the Indianapolis campus. Jamie, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Good morning.
Will you talk a little bit about what the organization that is asked for the survey does, and we can go into more detail about the findings that you all have come up with?
The Public Policy Institute staffs the Indiana Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, which is a state commission with state and local officials that was formed a very long time ago to work on intergovernmental issues, like things that, say, require both state and local government or different types of local governments to work on them. And we've done this survey 14 times since the late 90s, so we're kind of excited about the new results.
Well, tell us a little bit about the outcome of what have you discovered from the research, finding out how local officials are dealing with their problems these days.
Well, so if you think about it from the lens of what they identified as problems, we asked them about 78 different conditions, and they identified 40 of them, a majority of them identified 40 as either a major or moderate problem. In the top 10, they were all health issues, including drug abuse and drug crime. But if you think about it from the lens of what they thought local government should work on, the top issues were quality, affordable housing, local roads and streets, the vitality of downtowns, high-speed internet. And then drug abuse was fifth, and it was tied with K-12 education and population loss. So those actually are, a bunch of those are issues that were front and center in the General Assembly. So we hope that the survey provides some support for those discussions.
Let's take a look first at about drug abuse. I guess it rated pretty high as being a major or a moderate problem in the particular communities. How many local officials that you all were surveying turned in that as their key issue?
Well, let's see. That would be, there were a little over 600 officials that answered the survey. So it'd be about 300 that identified it as a major problem.
Oh.
When we ask them about the priorities, those get spread out more because they can only choose three versus deciding whether anything is a problem or not. Interestingly, it's actually a little bit less strong than in 2017, which was the last survey that we did. About 70% identified it as a major problem in 2017, and it was the number one issue to work on. So some communities must feel like they're doing, they're addressing it, and perhaps that the problem is getting to be a little bit less. But drug and alcohol abuse have been a big issue since I started doing the survey in the 1990s. It was mostly alcohol back then, but then it sort of transitioned to drug abuse.
Now, are you finding, and you've discovered this over the years with the surveys that you've been working with, that that a lot of the issues, of course, dealing with drug abuse and the like, are because people can't they don't have good enough jobs in many cases, and they in turn can't afford the housing, and that's where the affordable housing problem comes in?
I don't think our survey makes that particular connection. I think there are a lot of things that have combined to create the drug abuse problem that we have right now, as it's not only a low-income problem.
How about the affordable housing issue? It seemed to rank pretty high, I understand, in this survey.
It really does, and having talked to officials around the state, I think it's a big challenge. There's not a lot of stock being built right now. I'm sure you've heard people say it's a seller's market. So anything that's out there is getting, like, you know, swooped up very, very quickly. I think officials think, you know, if we want to attract more industry, we really don't have houses for folks to live in. So we're going to have to figure something out. The big challenge is that it's not the same problem everywhere. It's a little bit different problem than, say, here in Indianapolis, where we have lots of production builders, versus in the rural areas where they have, you know, basically have builders that build a few houses a year. Mm-hmm. And the economics are very different, because you can get economies of scale in a big market like Indianapolis or up in the northwest Indiana, whereas in a smaller rural place, the costs are just higher because you aren't building as much volume.
And I understand that different types of infrastructure also rank pretty high in the survey. In particular, a problem that the governor and his crew have been establishing a big priority, and that's internet connectivity. They've been trying to get more broadband established around the state. And how did that rate in the survey?
It was the fourth highest in terms of what locals thought they should be working on. I'm looking to see what it was in the problems. It was kind of middle of the road in terms of what they identified as problems. But it is a really, really critical issue. I know there's been a lot of debate about what we're going to call infrastructure, especially with the national discussion about bills. But it's really almost a basic infrastructure now, right? If you aren't able to have internet, it's pretty hard to function, and rural communities really aren't set up particularly well with either having it at all or having really good quality. And I think the pandemic actually has sort of put an exclamation point on that.
Yeah.
Because everybody's needed internet to function.
And how do we feel as far as the rest of the infrastructure? In this particular case, talking about local roads and streets and county highways, how do they seem to fare in the survey this year?
So local roads and streets have always been a big issue that these local kinds of local officials are concerned about. I think we're starting to see, I think about a third said their roads were improving in their community. So I think we're starting with the new gas tax money that we have available, with a little bit of a hiccup for the pandemic. We're really starting to see that communities are being able to catch up in terms of their backlog deal with, you know, their most damaged or poor quality roads. And so I expect it will continue to be an issue that they're concerned about, just because it's one of those bread and butter things that citizens pay attention to. But definitely we are, I think, making some progress with what the General Assembly has been working on.
Mm-hmm. Is it mainly that they'll be able to get a better idea of what to address? They've talked about it, I know, in this past session, and they probably have to plan for the future, and they're, of course, working with a new two-year state budget, so they have more money to work with than they had expected, and that might mean for some improvements, I suppose, in the future.
So I'm not sure the budget. I think we were sort of set with a gas tax for local roads and streets, but mm-hmm. certainly with broadband and water infrastructure, I think the budget's going to make a big difference.
Well, Jamie, thank you very much for spending time going through the survey for us now. And now with the results in from the local officials who participated this time around, is this something that lawmakers will have a chance to take a better look at through the rest of the year? And maybe they'll address some more of these issues in the session next year?
That's our hope. And it's a really rich data set. So we've put out a report, but there's all kinds of different ways we could cut these data. So mm-hmm. you know, there are communities who are interested in it. We certainly can think about ways that it would serve other policy discussions.
Well, that's good. Good to hear, too. Jamie Palmer is the lead researcher for this latest survey that has come out. It's called the 2020 Indiana Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations Survey, and it was conducted by the Indiana University Public Policy Institute, and Jamie works with the Policy Institute. And thank you very much for going down the data for us, and we hope that we have a chance to break out more of this, and we'll have more later soon. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
The tourism people and people who are encouraging folks to move and to live and work in Indiana like to mention the fact that Indiana is an affordable place to live, but there are some questions that need to be asked by many as to for whom is it affordable and compared to what? Well, there's an organization called the National Low Income Housing Coalition, along with the Indiana-based Prosperity Indiana, have come out with a report recently, and they found that there's a shortage of nearly 7 million affordable and available rental homes for extremely low-income renter households in the country. Let's find out more about the report and how Indiana fares in it. We have with us the policy director of Prosperity Indiana, Andrew Bradley, with us from his office in Indianapolis. And Andrew, thanks for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Will you fill us in on, first off, how the data was put together and what discovered how Indiana fares as far as having the affordable housing available that these organizations are touting is out there? How affordable housing really is available for Hoosier families?
Sure. Well, this report called The Gap looks at the number of affordable and available housing units, especially for renter families, throughout the country using available HUD data, census data, and basically just looking at like houses that translate to where people can actually live based on the income that they have. And so something that I found really striking looking at this data for Indiana is that, as you mentioned, Indiana prides itself on this reputation of being an affordable place to live. And sometimes that's used, frankly, by our policymakers as kind of a crutch not to do anything about issues like housing or income. But when it comes to affordable housing, Indiana actually has the second least number of affordable and available housing units per 100 renter families, and actually is also the second highest cost burden, meaning that people spend the most of their income on housing. So people are putting more of their dollars towards housing than most places in the Midwest. And at the same time, there are fewer units to go around. And actually for Northwest Indiana, that is even, those disparities are even wider than statewide.
Mm-hmm. In the report that came out, I was noticing some of the data, and they mentioned that you're talking about the available housing per 100, and there's 37 homes, rental homes for every 100 ELI renter households. That's not very much. What community or state, for that matter, fared about the same or was even less available?
So, you're right. Statewide, there are only 37 units, or imagine like apartments, available per 100 low-income renters. Now, for Northwest Indiana, it's even lower. It's only 32 affordable and available rental units per 100. Even just next door looking, I took a look at the Chicago metro area, they're at 34. So it's not just a matter of being part of this larger Chicagoland area region. It's a combination of having lower incomes and less attention on making sure that people have an affordable place to live.
We take a look at the data, of course, that most people take a look at, and we're looking at particularly before the COVID-19 pandemic hit, that there were a lot of problems for people to be able to afford to find affordable housing to begin with. What were some of the areas that they, in turn, were running into as their obstacles to be able to find affordable housing?
Well, that's exactly right. Indiana had a pre-existing condition when it comes to affordable housing and housing security. And one aspect of that, it does come down to eviction problems. Indiana has been shown to have one of the highest rates and numbers of evictions in the country. And this is ranked by another report by Eviction Lab out of Princeton University. And they have recently been showing real-time information during the COVID pandemic and are finding that in some counties in Indiana, including Lake County, evictions are actually up above pre-pandemic averages. despite the CDC eviction moratorium that's happening. So I think what we see coming out of that is that it is this combination of, you know, there's kind of a lack of really good, secure places where people are able to afford, where they can live, to have good, high-quality standards. And then also you have this pandemic on top and a lack of renter protection, and people are just kind of falling through the cracks.
Let's now talk about the pandemic. Since the pandemic hit more than a year ago, and you, of course, the data you probably have just covers the start of the pandemic, I'm sure, but we can kind of look ahead to the rest of the year and into 2021. What kind of problems have folks that can't afford the housing the most are facing now?
Well, you know, I do want to point out that, you know, housing is health care. In order, especially, and this has become very clear during this pandemic, that if people don't have a secure, stable place to live, then they're not able to do those things that we've all been talking about for the past year in terms of socially distance and make sure that you keep yourself clean and you're able to have the option to work from home or have children studying from home and keeping up with their peers. And when you have those eviction rates and you have that lack of affordable housing like Indiana does compared to its neighbors, it's no surprise that those associated public health and economic issues are going to be compounded. Something that we've seen from the last recession is that housing instability can be a lagging indicator because people, another saying goes that people, that rent eats first, that people will pay rent first and then sometimes skimp on other bases. So you may have people who have missed paychecks, maybe still are missing some paychecks or some shifts at work, and they're paying rent as much as they can. They're drawing down on savings. Maybe they're borrowing from friends and families. But when all those other lifelines run out, that's when evictions and foreclosures, too, can become a problem, sometimes months after the onset of other economic indicators.
Now, what does Prosperity Indiana and the LNIHC have to say about ways to resolve some of these issues?
Well, you know, this really is it's something that needs to be dealt with at the local, state, and federal level, right? The state General Assembly just wrapped up, and unfortunately there wasn't a lot done for housing stability. So we're really looking and focusing at what can be done at the federal level right now. And as you mentioned, Prosperity Indiana and our partners, our national partners at the National Low Income Housing Coalition, are really trying to make sure that our Indiana congressional delegation is aware of some of these options that are on the table. And when it comes to increasing and preserving the supply of affordable renting homes, we're asking that Congress increase the Housing Trust Fund to be able to build and preserve homes that are affordable to people at the lowest income. We want to make sure that we rehabilitate the public housing supply that we already have so that those don't deteriorate and become unavailable. And then finally, we're also asking Congress to use federal transportation investments to require inclusive zoning and land use reforms to reverse residential segregation and increase that supply of affordable homes.
Do you think that there's any possibility that some of the stimulus money that has come about and now the discussion of what can be used in federal funds for the infrastructure could be set aside and help out in this respect?
Yes, there's actually some really good news, both out of the most recent stimulus package that was passed. That had some funds set aside specifically for rental assistance. So that could hopefully stop some of the bleeding and some of the evictions. And I know that there are 7 different emergency rental assistance programs throughout the state, including one specifically for Lake County and one run by IHCDA for the rest of the state, that we're encouraging folks to call in. If you've missed income, make sure you apply so that we want to keep people stably housed. And then in this new infrastructure package that's being discussed, there's some provisions, including some from our current Senator Todd Young, that have been brought up in the past. That we're hoping will be considered in this new package that definitely get at affordable housing and also increasing that supply of affordable housing.
Andrew,
there is reason to be optimistic.
Well, Andrew, thank you for spending time going over the report and the data that's come out of it. And let's hope that our congressional delegation learns more and does some more to help solve the issue or at least work towards solving the issue of affordable housing. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Bradley is the policy director of Prosperity Indiana. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A Gary native and his wife are helping fund scholarships for a number of Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland students to Rose Holman Institute of Technology in Terre Haute. And Mike Masala, who is the Gary native, along with his wife Linda, are contributing this money for a way to help provide a pathway for young people who look to want to become engineers and related fields to be able to get the education that will get them ahead. Mike is with us today to talk about himself as the Gary native who made good, so to speak, as well as the opportunity for the scholarship fund. Thank you very much for being with us on Regionally Speaking today, Mike.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. My pleasure to join you.
Will you tell us first a little bit about yourself, about your life in Gary, Indiana, what got you from Gary to be able to attend Rose Holman Institute of Technology and move on in your career?
Well, thanks. So interestingly, all my grandparents came from Lebanon, so that's my heritage. I'm 100% Lebanese. And my mother and father had three children, three boys. Interestingly enough, my oldest brother, George, had Down syndrome, and he became the joy of our life. But we were like a lot of families back then whose my parents just worked to give their kids a better life. And my mother dedicated her life in many ways to help raise my brother George and create a community around that. And we always worked. We knew that if we were going to get ahead, that was part of it. So I was a paper boy for the Gary Pulse Tribune. I learned a lot of business skills from that, delivering 72 papers every day and then having to collect 35 cents from all those 72 people every 2 weeks. It was a good experience. I think people don't even know what a paper boy is right now. No. But as things got on, I got interested in math and science, and I knew to pay for my own education that I was also going to need to work, and I was fortunate enough to get a job working the summers at U.S. Steel, and U.S. Steel was very big back in the day, and that was a fantastic job to be able to create some savings. And I got an opportunity to go to, it used to be called Rose Polytechnic Institute, now Rose Holman Institute of Technology, which is a small but excellent engineering school in Terre Haute, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I was thrilled to be able to do that.
What experiences did you go through at Rose Holman and that you've been able to besides going to class and all the related activities of being a student, did you be able to put together that got you started in your business career later?
I wish I could tell you I was an overnight success. I really wasn't. I was pretty excited to get out of the house and live independently. And my first few years, or my first year at least, I was also interested in having a lot of fun. But ultimately learned, especially with an engineering curriculum, that you really needed to apply yourself if you were going to be successful and get serious about it. And I learned that at Rose, and fortunately enough, it was one of those schools that was small and you had some dedicated teachers that really paid attention to their students. You didn't get lost. And just broadly, a community around you that was supportive. And so I was able to kind of grow up and mature at the same time I was developing engineering skills. And those engineering skills turned out to be really helpful for just general problem solving, just organized ways of going about work. Also created a mindset where you tried to connect the dots and know how everything worked together. So I was the beneficiary of getting a great education, which got me started.
I understand that you've had your career mainly as an engineer, chemical engineer, actually, in the life sciences business fields. I know you'd worked with company Baxter, which is a very big player in the life sciences industry, providing materials and all for all kinds of facilities, hospitals and labs and the like. And you are now, I understand, chairman and CEO of Edwards Life Sciences, which came about, I guess, after you left Baxter. Obviously, you've been able to put all of your skills together, the things you learned in college and in future jobs from that to work. Is that what you're hoping as well, that you will be able to do with scholarship fund that you and your wife Linda have created for Rose Holman?
Yeah, it was a journey for me. Chemical engineers, I found out, worked in oil refineries and chemical plants, and that was my first job, actually, was working for Union Carbide. But ultimately, I decided that my career would be more fulfilling if I was involved in healthcare. in trying to really help people live better lives through medical technology. And that's what caused me to join Baxter, and I grew up there for 20 years. And then I've been in the role that I've been now for 20 years with Edwards Lifesciences. And we are a company that specializes in helping people with structural heart disease or the critically ill. Some incredible technologies like being able to replace your heart valve with a catheter and not even having to open your chest or stop your heart to do that. So some pretty incredible stuff. And it's a very global business. I've had a chance to see the world and work with some of the best physicians, policymakers, et cetera. And so I just feel like I've been so fortunate in my career to see so much, do so much, and I wanted to find a way to be able to give back. Mm-hmm. And I think about folks from the region, especially those that are very bright but maybe just don't have the means to get there. And I thought, you know, if they could have a similar experience to what I had, which is to get a great education at a school like Rose, and then supplement that with a leadership experience and an international experience, that it could put them on the road to a really wonderful life. And so we created this scholarships, and actually should be able to touch 6 students every year with that kind of experience.
And you're looking for students from Northwest Indiana and from the Chicagoland area. So you're specifically helping the people in a way that that came up after you, after they finished high school. They're looking now to go into a good career in the hopes of being an engineer or something related, and take advantage of being a graduate of Rose. I'd like to ask here a little bit about what you've been able to do in the past to help your colleagues and the campus in general. But first, if you will, tell us a little bit more in detail about the scholarship program.
So the scholarship program, as you say, is particularly for those in Northwest Indiana and South Chicago. As a matter of fact, for those of us that grow up around there, we call it the region.
Right.
If we could define that, that's really what it's for. And it's for a full-ride tuition scholarship to Rose Holman. And that in addition to paying all the tuition and so forth, it would also have 2 other components to it. One, an enriching international experience, and the other, a leadership experience. So the international experience could be like a summer course overseas, or a quarter or a semester overseas. It could be customized between the school and the student, depending on their interest. And then a leadership opportunity would be a chance for the student to attend some kind of a leadership enrichment experience, so an academic conference, an internship at a nonprofit or a community service, many opportunities to demonstrate leadership. And I found both those to be personally really gratifying, and think that the engineering and science education of Rose supplemented with that could be even better.
As far as you know, when will the first 4-year scholarships go out to the young people under this program?
Immediately, a matter of fact. So I know that there are several students that were just in for a special weekend where they were made familiar, and some offers are out right now to, I think, the first 3 candidates for this. And so we're excited that it's already getting off the ground.
Well, it's good to hear. Now, if you will, tell us a bit more about the interest that you and Linda have had over years since graduating from Rose Holman and gone out into the working world. But you've wanted to help the campus in a lot of ways in Terre Haute. What are some of the other efforts that you've shown to support the Institute over the last few years?
Again, I feel very, very fortunate to have my life go the way it has. And my educational experience really was a crossroad, and I benefited so much from that. And my wife has been, Linda has been enormously supportive as well. And there became an opportunity to create a new student union at Rose. You know, this is kind of the center of activity. This is where people go for their meals. This is where you hang out. This is where you get some relaxing time. This is where you get a quiet place to study, maybe outside of your room. And to try and upgrade that and make that something that was a source of pride for the school is something that we were in touch with, because we know that education is about the whole person. And so we provided a lead gift in creating the new union, and it's named the Massalem Union, and we're very proud that that took place. And then subsequent to that, we funded a little building right next to it that the school called the Pi Billion, which named a bit after an engineering term called Pi, which is talks about the circumference of a circle.
That's right.
And this is another kind of just a cool hangout place that's designed with a lot of very modern environmental techniques, but again, kind of a cool hangout place that could be anything from an educational opportunity to totally a social event.
Well, Mike, here's hoping that you and Linda have a chance to, obviously you do what you can to try to make it back from California to Terre Haute and Northwest Indiana, for that matter, to visit, as well as come back to campus. And hopefully you'll have a chance to meet more of the people that are able to get the Musallam scholarships in the future. And we thank you for spending time going over your life, your experiences in business, and how all that together has been able to shape up along with yours and your wife's experience in creating a very important $4 million plus Rose Holman Scholarship Program for the folks here in Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland to be able to take advantage of. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Thanks, Chris. We're honored, and thank you for the work that you do in the community.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we'll have conversations from the Indiana State Police about a major consumer scam that started out in eastern Indiana but could be statewide by now. We'll find out more about it. It's all ahead here on Regionally Speaking.